In Sedona, Arizona, jury selection begins today in a trial involving three people who died during a spiritual warrior retreat in 2009. The retreat was run by self-help guru James Arthur Ray, who was on trial for manslaughter. Daniel Crocker of member station KNAU reports that local businesses catering to spiritual tourists are struggling.
The Angel Valley Retreat Center stretches along the banks of bubbling Oak Creek just south of Sedona. Nearly a year and a half ago, it was a chaotic scene here as emergency responders evacuated 20 people.
This is the place where the sweat lodge used to be and where the incident took place.
Amira Hamilton runs Angel Valley with her husband. Now on this site, there's a circle of stones outlining where the sweat lodge used to be. In the middle are the stones actually used to heat the sweat lodge, laid out in the shape of a heart.
When we took them out, when we took the sweat lodge down, they just formed themselves into a heart.
And that led them to turn this into a memorial of sorts. In addition to the criminal case against James Ray, people who were in the sweat lodge and victims' families have brought 10 lawsuits against Angel Valley. Amidst all this, business was down 50% last year after 5 years of steady growth.
I think most of all has to do with people being unsure what exactly happened. You know, so there's uncertainty.
Sedona is a mecca for spiritual travelers. For decades, they've flocked to what locals refer to as Sedona's vortices. These are swirling centers of energy that some believe flow out of the region's stunning red rock formations. Now cottage industries have popped up to serve visitors' spiritual needs.
Healers, counselors, teachers, tours, psychic readers, energetic healers, goes on and on.
That's Lucy Goudreau. She owns the Golden Word Bookstore, which specializes in spiritual and metaphysical books. For her, business has also dropped. She's a retired teacher and has had to dip into savings to keep her store afloat.
I literally see people walking around with their cell phones, adding up prices and deciding which of the things they're going to buy, which when we first got here, I did not see at all.
But Goudreau attributes her struggles to the recession, not to fallout from the James Ray incident. Jennifer Wesselhoff, CEO of the Sedona Chamber of Commerce, says a lot of her members have seen revenues decline by 20% or more. But she agrees it's hard to know what's causing it.
The recession, the AIG effect on our meetings and events market.
Not to mention Arizona's controversial immigration law and the recent shooting in Tucson. But some spiritual entrepreneurs say what they offer is recession-proof. Mark Pinkham leads Vortex Tours in Sedona. He says his business has never been better.
Maybe in a recession it's even more important. To feel that connection to the spirit, to a higher power when things are difficult in your life.
These tourists don't make travel decisions based on money, says Kevin Wright, who's written several books on religious and spiritual travel. And as a result,
the leisure traveler market is down quite a bit, whereas the spiritual religious market, it may be down a little bit or it's holding steady.
Back at Angel Valley Retreat Center, Amira Hamilton says she's starting to get more interest in bookings.
We get questions like, are you open? Yes, we are.
But she's worried that the James Ray trial may bring negative energy to a place where spiritual seekers come to escape it. Opening statements are scheduled for March 1st. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Crocker.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. We've arrived at an easy moment to blame politicians. The government is running a deficit expected to be $1.6 trillion this fiscal year. Debate has begun over how to bring deficits down. Republicans, for example, have proposed cutting funding for needy women, infants, and children. The White House budget includes a plan to slash low-income heating subsidies. And we've heard warnings of fiscal disaster if we don't act. So it's easy to blame our elected officials. Those surveys remind us of an underlying reality. We elected them, and most voters want more government than we're willing to pay for. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Budget-cutting proposals are bumper to bumper these days, but even as he proposes cuts in some areas, President Obama wants to spend more federal money to update and improve the country's overstretched roads and bridges.
The delays that you expect between the Beltway and 50 Fair Oaks, but
traffic-weary commuters can only honk in support when the president calls for stepped-up investment in infrastructure, as he did in Michigan last week.
If we want new jobs and businesses here in America, we've got to have the best transportation system. and the best communication network in the world. It's like that movie, Field of Dreams. You know, if we build it, they will come. But we've got to build it.
A survey for the Rockefeller Foundation found overwhelming support for infrastructure investment. Pollster Jay Campbell, who conducted the survey, says that backing cuts across party lines.
In a time and place when Republicans almost pride themselves on disagreeing with everything that President Obama stands for, 66% of Republicans said that they agreed with this approach.
But even the most ardent supporters of highway spending hit the brakes when pollsters started asking if they'd be willing to help pay for it.
Where support did start to drop off, and did so quite dramatically, is when voters themselves are asked to help foot the bill.
Survey respondents rejected the idea of paying for roads with higher gasoline taxes by a better than 2-to-1 margin. Additional toll charges were almost as unpopular. In other words, if you build it, Americans will come, so long as they don't have to pay for it.
The overarching problem is people want everything to change and they want nothing to change at the same time. It puts elected leaders in a really tough position.
For years now, elected leaders have dealt with that challenge by indulging Americans' desire for services without trying to collect. That's one reason we're now staring at a $1.6 trillion deficit. While congressional Republicans are proposing dramatic cuts in discretionary spending, most Americans are hard-pressed to identify specific parts of the government they're willing to do without. A survey by the Pew Research Center found the only government program where there's anything close to a cutting consensus is foreign aid.
Foreign aid is the least popular aspect of the budget typically, and you see that in this survey as well.
That's Carol Dougherty of the Pew Research Center.
But even here, you still get less than 50% saying cut it, and it's not overwhelming, even though that's the largest area on our list.
Dougherty says for the most popular programs, like Medicare and education, only about 1 in 10 people favor cuts. Still, there are some signs the growing deficit is making people more careful what they wish for. Fewer survey respondents now ask for more government spending in areas like defense and health care than did just 2 years ago.
I think it's a recognition that the government can't spend as it has been. I think that's sinking in on the public. But taking that next step and really applying the knife to these programs is a more difficult thing.
So when political leaders seem timid about cutting the biggest government programs or asking people to pay more for them, they're simply taking their cues from the people who elected them. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This week we're looking at cities in transition as demographics shift in American cities and suburbs. And here's a trend. Every year, thousands of 20-somethings move to Portland, Oregon. Many of these new residents don't have kids or a mortgage, which is a good thing because many of them also don't have jobs. And there are not a lot of jobs in Portland. Amelia Templeton reports on why people keep coming.
Hundreds of food carts have taken over empty parking lots downtown. You can get everything from pad thai to a fried pie. In one cart, Jonathan Balderi is handing a customer a cheeseburger.
Thank you. It'll just be a few minutes.
Thank you. Balderi's 28, and like a lot of young people here, he came to Portland to get away from somewhere else.
My ex-girlfriend decided to go to art school here, and I wanted to leave Pennsylvania.
Behind Balderi in the cart, Quentin Gardner is huddled over the grill. Gardner says he had to get out of Binghamton, New York. All he knew about Portland was it had a great heavy metal rock scene. And he says he's found a lot of people like himself here.
It seems to be a mecca for the misplaced half-caste rock and rollers. A lot of half-African, half-y, half-black, half-white rockers out here and metalheads and punk rockers. I like that a lot. It seems to be that I chose the correct place to come if this is where we're all flocking to.
Portland has scooped up 20-somethings from shrinking cities in the Northeast and the Midwest. It gets the kids who dream of being in a rock band. But the city has also drawn well-educated young professionals. In fact, the entire population is growing. African Americans, whites, and Hispanics. Standing in the rain at this food cart is economist Joe Courtwright.
Talent is becoming more concentrated in some cities and then moving away from other cities.
20 years ago, the percentage of people with college degrees here was lower than the national average. Now it's more than 10 points higher, about 40%. Courtwright says the grads aren't just coming for high-tech jobs.
People in the Portland metropolitan area are much more likely to be engaged in almost any form of outdoor recreation. We have more microbreweries than any other city in the United States.
Yep, beer and the great outdoors. Turns out the stereotypes about Portland are largely true. In fact, right next to us at a Korean food cart, a young attorney in a fleece is picking up lunch. His name is John Sturm, and he moved to Portland from Oklahoma.
I do a lot of homebrewing, and I've got an amazing number of folks who are into that scene. Biking to work and knowing that so many of my friends and peers are in that community and that culture is great.
I can't think of another explanation besides quality of life.
That's state economist Christian Kaler. He says wages here are sometimes 20% lower than in Seattle or San Francisco. But people keep coming. In fact, Portland's appeal is part of why the city's unemployment rate tends to be about a point higher than the national average.
In recessions, Portland tends to see population growth even as we lose jobs. So one of the reasons we have that higher unemployment rate is because people do continue to move here even as jobs disappear.
Kaler says the city's strong brand as a livable place makes it more attractive to companies, too.
I'll tell a story.
It's about Sun Microsystems asking some of its employees if they would relocate. The company was trying to decide whether to shutter a plant in Portland or in Silicon Valley.
And the responses were night and day. The skilled California workers they wanted to keep were enthusiastic about relocating their family to the Portland area. The Portland employees who were skilled indicated that they would quit rather than relocate in the Bay Area.
While Portland companies have a great pool of talent to draw on, it's not a diverse pool. Portland is still about 80% white. And there are historical reasons for that. Oregon voted to outlaw slavery, but for 75 years, voters also banned blacks from moving here. During World War II, thousands of African Americans came to Portland to work in the booming shipyards. But in 1948, the Columbia River flooded and permanently destroyed the neighborhood where the shipbuilders lived. Today, it's not ships, but rather chips and sneakers, Intel and Nike, that offer a livable wage. Enrique Washington helps these large firms recruit minority candidates. He says his clients want a diverse staff to help them innovate and connect to consumers.
The more diverse culture you have, the better your stock prices do.
In fact, Portlanders often mention the engineers at Intel as an example of diversity here. Washington says Portland is slowly growing more diverse. There's a lot of international migration, and about 10% of the city is Hispanic. But, he says, minority recruits worry there's not a strong community to raise their children in.
People have not made a decision to move here because a lack of people of their particular color, be it Hispanic, be it African American, be it Asian American.
So cities like Portland that don't have much diversity to start with struggle to attract it. Back at the food carts, I ask Gardner, the half-black rocker, if Portland's whiteness bothers him. He says it all depends on your frame of reference. Portland may only be 6% African American, but he's lived in whiter places.
So to me, it's actually got a pretty reasonable sized black community. I see black. I can look down the street and I can spot a black person somewhere. See?
If you are considering moving here, Gardner's heavy metal band is looking for a drummer. For NPR News in Portland, Oregon, I'm Amelia Templeton.
We're looking at cities in transition all week, and you can find more stories from the series at NPR.org. Next, we travel to Phoenix to find out why foreign-born workers are faring better in this economy than people who are native-born.
I think it's flexibility and a certain desperation.
That's coming tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Today in Wisconsin, thousands of protesters descended on the state capitol to oppose a budget proposal by the new Republican governor, Scott Walker. Governor Walker wants to strip government unions of most bargaining rights. He argues that would help bring public sector benefits in line with the private sector. As Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson reports, many union members think the governor is trying to bust their unions.
All this week, workers have flocked to the Capitol in giant waves of protests. Today, they're outside at a rally on the Capitol lawn and picketing the streets on the Capitol Square. Crowds numbering as many as 13,000 have at times shut down traffic. Unions contend today's crowd is closer to 30,000. So many Madison public school teachers called in sick today that the district closed down. Inside, protesters in the Capitol's hallways and rotunda are chanting, "Kill the bill." The bill would patch a $137 million hole in the state's current budget. but in the process rework collective bargaining laws that were written 50 years ago. A public hearing on it that started at 10 in the morning yesterday went until 3 this morning, when even though people were still waiting to speak, lawmakers shut it down. Brian Kennedy heads the union AFT Wisconsin, which represents 17,000 government employees.
It keeps getting bigger and bigger every day. He needs to back down. He needs to leave the public sector workers alone. Because what we're seeing now are even more private sector workers showing up. It's just getting bigger and bigger because they know this is an assault on all workers. This is not just an assault on people who work for the state.
As you might expect, Governor Walker and his supporters framed the issue much differently. Walker campaigned on bringing public employee benefits in line with the private sector. Right now, most state workers, including employees of Wisconsin Public Radio, pay next to nothing toward their pension and favorable rates for health care. Governor Walker proposes what would amount to about an 8% pay cut for workers. He calls it a modest proposal.
When people look at this, particularly for people outside of government, they look at this and say this is a pretty good deal.
It's also a place that governors in other states are looking to find savings as they face crushing budget deficits. But it's the other part of Walker's plan that's stirring unions here into a frenzy. He wants to eliminate the right of government and employee unions to bargain for health care and pensions and limit their ability to bargain for wages. Governor Walker says bargaining would be pointless. The state has nothing to negotiate.
The truth is we don't have money to offer. We don't have finances to offer. This is what we have to offer. And if you're going to negotiate, you got to have something to offer. We don't have something. So we're laying it out on the table.
State clerical worker Mike Lowry calls it a war on unions.
Hell yeah. If they can do it to people in Wisconsin with its historic working class roots, it can be done anywhere.
Professor Gary Chasen is an expert on labor relations at Clark University in Massachusetts. He says New Jersey Republican Governor Chris Christie has made a name for himself by talking tough with unions. But Chasen says what Scott Walker is doing here goes beyond that.
And most states are just willing to say, we're going to be tough in bargaining. Okay. But what's happening in Wisconsin is they're saying, we're going to do this without bargaining, and that's quite a different thing.
A similar scene could soon play out in Ohio, where newly elected Republican Governor John Kasich wants to end collective bargaining for public employee unions. In Wisconsin, Republicans control the legislature, and the bill could pass quickly, though unions say some GOP lawmakers are now backing down. Even if unions win this fight, the consequences could be dire. Governor Walker says it could lead to the layoffs of thousands of state and local employees. For NPR News, I'm Sean Johnson in Madison.